This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
America's energy future makes for strange bedfellows. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is an archived edition of To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Republicans and Democrats often promise to do something about the price of gasoline. The jury's still out on this year's energy bill. Meantime, though, two unlikely allies are pushing for cars they claim could get 500 miles to the gallon with available technology and alternative fuels. Environmentalists want to clean up the air. Hawks and neocons say dependence on fossil fuels is a threat to security. On To the Point, would the technology really work? Would it require more energy rather than less? On Reporter's Notebook later on, DNA and human migration 50,000 years ago. First the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with an archived edition of To the Point. Despite claims about this year's energy bill, the price of gasoline's by no means under control. On To the Point, an unlikely alliance is still pushing for cars they claim could get 500 miles to the gallon. Can hawks and neocons work with environmentalists to solve America's energy problems? On Reporter's Notebook, can DNA help to trace human migration routes from 50,000 years ago? First, this news update. When Congress adjourned for the holidays, left a lot of work to be done. Next week, the Senate Judiciary Committee will begin hearings on Samuel Alito, President Bush's nominee to succeed Sandra Day O'Connor on the U.S. Supreme Court. Joan Biskupic is author of the new book, Sandra Day O'Connor, How the First Woman on the Supreme Court Became Its Most Influential Justice. She covers the court for USA Today. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
What are the major issues facing the justice?
Well, we'll see a lot of old issues such as abortion and privacy, and we'll see some new ones that the senators will ask about. For example, executive power, questions about wiretaps in light of the news of the National Security Agency wiretapping domestic calls. I'm sure we're going to see other questions related to the Bush administration's legal strategy against terrorism. So you'll see a replay of some of the questions that we had when John Roberts was up for the Chief Justice spot, but some other ones that reflect recent news.
What is Judge Alito's record when it comes to government power, executive power, and the idea of domestic surveillance, for example?
Well, it's not clear-cut. First of all, he is an individual who worked closely in the Reagan administration. He was in the Justice Department in several key spots, and then he's been on the federal court since 1990. So he has had an opportunity to take many, many actions, but a lot of these questions that we now have on executive power are very new, and he's never had to say anything about the executive's power during wartime, and I think that's the kind of thing that the senators will probe him on.
Are there cases that are expected to arise while he's on the court that have to do with those issues?
That's an excellent question, because the justices have already said that they will take a case this spring that tests whether the Bush administration may use military tribunals to try foreign terrorism suspects. And that case will be heard sometime in the weeks after Sam Alito could be confirmed to the Supreme Court.
What about redistricting? And that brings up the name, of course, of Tom DeLay, who is currently sort of in absentia in the Congress, having had to give up his leadership position because of some legal problems.
That's right. And in fact, the Supreme Court has agreed to review this spring the Texas legislature's plan that Tom DeLay actually orchestrated a few years ago. It redrew voting districts to help Republicans gain seats in Congress. And this case is one that I'm sure will be on Senate Judiciary Committee members' minds, because if Sam Alito is approved for the Supreme Court, he will come on and essentially hear that case in oral arguments and then be able to decide it by their summer recess.
any record on Judge Alito's part on that issue?
Well, that's a good question. And when he was in the Reagan administration, he wrote a memo to Attorney General Edwin Meese that suggested some skepticism for some of the more liberal Supreme Court rulings on reapportionment and one person, one vote. And Senator Edward Kennedy, a Democrat from Massachusetts, says that he wants to question Sam Alito specifically on his idea of the Constitution's guarantee of equality when it comes to voting rights.
Your book, the subtitle of which is How the First Woman on the Supreme Court Became Its Most Influential Justice, is about Sandra Day O'Connor, whom, if he's confirmed, Judge Alito will replace. What sort of difference do you see? What would be, do you think would be the major differences other than gender between the two?
Well, I think, first of all, you're going to see it. You could potentially see a change on abortion rights. She's been the swing vote on abortion rights toward the more liberal side. You could see a change in protections against sex discrimination. She's been the swing vote to go over to the more liberal side on that. And also, even on another topic that's hotter today, death penalty appeals. Justice O'Connor had been quite strict and conservative on some questions dealing with the death penalty, but in recent terms, she's actually shown herself to be more open to concerns about the competency of counsel in death penalty cases. And in fact, she was a key vote in a recent decision that reversed an opinion of Sam Alito's from the lower court that involved his view of a death penalty case. In this situation, the justices reversed Judge Alito and threw out the death penalty.
You're suggesting, I think, as have others, that it could make more of a difference when Judge Alito, if he's confirmed, replaces Sandra Day O'Connor than it did when the Chief Justice, John Roberts, replaced William Rehnquist.
I'm definitely suggesting that. I think Sandra Day O'Connor holds a unique position on the court just by virtue of her swing vote and also by virtue of the fact that she has tended to be the author of some of the key opinions setting the rationale for things like abortion rights and affirmative action. And with her departure, the court could tip in one direction away from where she had set the course. So I think that it could change things just because he's succeeding O'Connor, or he may succeed O'Connor. But also, remember, the late Justice Byron White used to say, you change one justice, you change the whole court. So I think there'll be a whole reordering of the nine when we have a new successor to Justice O'Connor.
All right. A very major event in the history of the third branch of government, the U.S. Supreme Court. And Joan Biskupic, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Warren.
Reporter for USA Today, author of Sandra Day O'Connor, How the First Woman on the Supreme Court Became Its Most Influential Justice. I'll be right back with To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To the Point. Set America Free is a coalition of former national security officials, hawks and neocons, who aren't much worried about the environment. But they have joined forces with the National Resources Defense Council to end America's dependence on fossil fuels. Frank Gaffney was Assistant Defense Secretary during the Reagan administration. Mr. Gaffney, good to have you back on our program.
It's great to be back with you.
In a moment, I want to hear about the 500-mile-per-gallon car. But first, tell our listeners what this has to do, do you think, with national security?
I think it has everything to do with national security. Our principal motivation behind Set America Free is an appreciation that we are looking increasingly at a world in which oil is imported from countries that are at best unstable and at worst downright hostile to us. That makes some of those sources at least possibly unreliable for a critically important commodity, present especially in our transportation sector, which uses roughly two-thirds of the oil that we import. It has as well to do with the fact that even if those suppliers are reliable, a number of them at least are using the proceeds of the oil they sell us for things that are very inimical to our security, weapons of mass destruction purchases and proliferation, for example, support for terror, another. Another problem, of course, of a considerable importance to national security is the fact that terrorists have discovered that blowing up infrastructure that supports oil imports, whether it's overseas or perhaps in the future here at home, it allows them to exploit our vulnerability and compound it. And then finally, there's another national security problem looming on the horizon, and that is that Communist China, and to some extent India as well, are becoming very, very aggressive competitors with us for a finite and possibly contracting quantity of oil on the world market. All of this is contributing, I think, to not only higher prices, but to a circumstance that we simply can no longer tolerate. We have to begin doing something that we have talked about doing for a long time, namely to dramatically reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And fortunately, the good news is that there are ways at hand to do that.
Let's talk about the 500-mile-per-gallon car. We're talking with Frank Gaffney at the Center for Security Policy. Go ahead.
Well, I hope I'm not disclosing anything personal, but I know that you drive a hybrid today. That is an example of the kind of technology that is available now, that is a sort of baseline upon which we could build. If in addition to having an internal combustion engine and battery, as your hybrid does, we could have a flexible fuel feature added to that internal combustion component and a plug-in feature available on the hybrid battery component, it is entirely possible that you could get between 300 and 500 miles per gallon of gasoline consumed, simply because the internal combustion engine can use less oil, perhaps rely entirely on alternative fuels like ethanol and methanol, and the battery can use the electrical grid as a power supply, something that would greatly reduce the amount of oil we would need to power the transportation sector if electricity could, in fact, become part of how we power that sector.
How soon do you think we could develop a car like that and get it on the market and establish the infrastructure that would be needed for the plug-in?
Well, they're here now. There are prototypes, certainly, of plug-in hybrids. There are some 4 million cars with flexible fuel vehicle features in them. And it really is a case in every one of these instances of the technologies I've talked about, ethanol, methanol, biodiesel, electricity, automotive technologies that can take advantage of them. Being here, it's just a question of essentially scaling them up so that they can be widely exploited by consumers who, I think, particularly at today's prices, would be only too happy to rely less and less and less on expensive gasoline and the need to fill up their tanks with regularity.
Frank Gaffney, again, with the Center for Security Policy. And tell our listeners a few of the other members of your organization, in addition to James Woolsey, the former director of the CIA.
Well, it's a diverse group, as you said. Bud McFarlane, that former National Security Advisor to President Reagan, is on it. The Apollo Alliance, a group representing, among others, automotive industry unions. Congressman Elliot Engel, a Democrat from New York. Gary Bauer, the president of American Values. James Watkins, a former Secretary of Energy. Professor Richard Smalley, the Nobel laureate in chemistry for 1996. This is a distinguished company, we think. Many of us coming at it, as I said, from a national security perspective, but I think also lending validity to the other point that I made, which is that we can do something about this energy dependency problem, and in fact that we have no choice but to do something about it now.
Frank Gaffney, formerly with the Defense Department during the Reagan years, now at the Center for Security Policy. Dan Lashoff is Senior Scientist and Deputy Director of the Climate Center at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Dan Lashoff, welcome to you.
Oh, thank you.
You, as I understand it, have found common ground with Mr. Gaffney's organization, but for very different reasons. You're not so worried about national security as you are about the environment.
Well, I'm worried about national security, too, but NRDC came at this from a different starting point, certainly focused on ways to reduce emissions of heat-trapping pollution that cause global warming and to reduce the pressure to drill in pristine wilderness areas for the last drops of oil that lie within the boundaries of the United States. What we found of great interest in this coalition is that we arrived at essentially the same set of solutions, which is the need for a national commitment to reduce our oil consumption by a very significant amount. And we concluded that we could, with a national commitment, reduce our oil use by 2.5 million barrels a day, within a decade, which is the amount of oil we currently import from the Middle East. And by 2025, we could reduce our oil consumption by something like 10 million barrels a day, which is about half of what we currently consume.
What would that, or how would that work, given what Frank Gaffney told us earlier about the idea of a flexible fuel plug-in hybrid vehicle?
Well, that could certainly be a significant component. In the near term, we can make the biggest gains by improving the fuel efficiency of conventional vehicles that will continue to run on gasoline for a while. But, you know, there are a wide variety of measures that can contribute. Certainly hybrid vehicles, which are available now but are not widely purchased. I mean, there's still less than 1% of the vehicle market, so we need to really expand that market quite dramatically to make the kind of impact that we need to make fleet-wide. And increasing the use of alternative fuels like ethanol, which is currently produced from corn, but with new technology could be produced from agricultural waste and from dedicated energy crops such as switchgrass, which is a perennial and doesn't require the same level of agricultural inputs that are required to make corn. So there are many options, and what we are proposing is an approach that would leave a lot of flexibility about how to get the oil savings, but that would require that we achieve realistic but meaningful targets for reducing our oil consumption.
What should the government do? How should it help this technology to be developed?
Well, first of all, we have to not move in the wrong direction. What we should be doing instead is requiring an increasing share of our fleet be capable of running on alternative fuels. And we should require the administration to develop and implement a strategy for reducing our oil consumption by 2.5 million barrels a day in a decade and 10 million barrels a day by 2025 using a combination of existing authority that's on the books, incentives such as performance-based tax credits to help expand the market for renewable fueled vehicles or hybrid vehicles, and other things like standards for replacement tires, which are typically less efficient than the kinds of tires that are on vehicles when they are first sold to consumers. That particular provision wastes about or would save about 3 or 4% of our fuel use. It's not going to solve the problem by itself, but it's a simple thing that we can do that would be part of a comprehensive strategy.
Dan Lashoff with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Back to Frank Gaffney with the Center for Security Policy. Do you agree with that? Do you think incentives, tax credits, that kind of thing in order to push the alternative energy market are a good idea?
I do think they're a good idea. There are places in which it makes more sense than others. Some of the suggestions that we've just heard, I think, are likely to fracture this coalition we've built. I don't know that we would all agree on some of the mandates for reducing oil consumption. We'd prefer to see that done by these sorts of techniques of encouraging the market and enabling it to respond to a clear national security need.
And that's partly because your goal is different, is it not, from the Natural Resources Defense Council, where they're concerned about some environmental trade-offs. You aren't.
Well, look, we all breathe the same air and we all drink the same water. I'm able to get to a point where I think we're doing the right thing for national security reasons that can have benefits to the environment. Mm-hmm. I personally would approach it from that perspective rather than try to do things that might maximize the environmental benefit, but in turn would perhaps cost us the kind of broad-based support that I think we're going to need to get what has to be done for national security reasons.
All right. At any rate, we see, for the moment at least, a coalition developing between the hawks and neocons represented by Mr. Gaffney and the environmentalists represented by Dan Lashoff. Let us talk now to a naysayer. Jerry Taylor is director of natural resources at the Cato Institute, which is a conservative libertarian public policy organization in Washington. And Jerry Taylor, we're glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
You don't like these ideas.
No, I don't. I first of all find them a bit disingenuous. After all, if foreign oil is not the problem. Oil imports are not the problem. Even if the United States was energy independent, a terrorist attack in Saudi Arabia or disruption in supply out of that region would have just as big effect on us as if all our oil came from Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. So the idea that foreign oil is a unique problem is nonsense. It's oil consumption that's the issue. And secondly, this is a coalition to provide corporate welfare checks to people for the most part. I think to protect our national security against terrorist threats abroad, we need to go out and find terrorists abroad, and we're not going to beat these terrorists by giving welfare checks to General Motors or Ford Motor or to Archer Daniels Midland or anybody else in the corporate energy sector. If technologies have merit, the sorts of things that Frank Gaffney were talking about, we don't need to subsidize them. Investors will put their money in those technologies out of hopes of profit. But if they don't have economic merit, no amount of government encouragement, enabling, whatever Frank wants to call it, in reality we're talking about subsidy, is going to give them merit. And we have 40 years of experience where we have thrown money at technologies that look pretty good to politicians in Washington or people outside of the industry who thought they were experts, and it was money that we ended up flushing down the toilet.
So why do you say that foreign oil importing is not a problem? How can we do without it under our current economic situation? Wouldn't we be better off and less vulnerable if we could produce our own energy?
Well, actually, in 1979, we have a perfect case study. Great Britain was energy independent. It got all the oil it needed from the North Sea. It didn't import anything from the Middle East or from anywhere else, for that matter. But the Iranian Revolution in 1979 sent the price of crude in Great Britain just as high as it sent the price of crude in Japan, which was entirely dependent upon imports. We have a global marketplace here. It doesn't matter where the oil comes from. A disruption of supply anywhere in the market is going to affect everybody in the market, whether they're energy independent or not.
So it's a false goal, then, you're saying?
Independence per se is a false goal. I think to the extent to which Mr. Gaffney may have a complaint, it's not with foreign oil, it's with oil use in general. But of course, for conservatives and Republicans to talk about the worrisome nature of the fact that we use a lot of oil is a little bit off-putting to some Republicans, so it's easier to couch this as a complaint about foreign oil. But it's oil that's the problem. Now, frankly, if we have any reason to call for government intervention of that market, and oil tax is the better way to do it. But to go about and pick winners or losers in the economy and say, well, we should put our eggs in a plug-in hypercar, or we should put our eggs in ethanol, or we should put our eggs in hybrid technologies, or we should put our eggs in hydrogen-powered fuel cells, I don't know which is the best bet. I'll guarantee you that Frank Gaffney doesn't know for certain which is the best bet. Even investors are split. But the difference between me and investors in the market is that investors have most of the incentive to get it right. They're the ones who are either going to become millionaires on the bet or are going to go broke and flip burgers because of their bet, and they're the ones who are going to allocate those resources better than people in Washington, D.C.
We've just been listening to Jerry Taylor, Director of Natural Resource Studies at the Cato Institute, again, of course, a conservative libertarian public policy group in Washington, D.C. In a moment, we'll hear the rest of this program as valid, as you can hear, as when we recorded it last spring. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, can DNA help to trace human migration routes from 50,000 years ago? On To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Well, I'm only back with To the Point from Public Radio International, talking today about the oil economy. Does the oil economy and dependence on foreign oil in particular make us especially vulnerable? We just heard Jerry Taylor of the Cato Institute say it really doesn't, because whatever happens to the price of oil, it happens globally. And even if you're energy independent, your prices are going to go up. Let me go back to Frank Gaffney on the Center for Security Policy on that one. Jerry Taylor says the real problem is oil itself, but a lot of Republicans don't want to deal with that issue.
Look, the real problem at the moment is oil that is unfortunately of uncertain supply overseas. We need to have sources of oil for the foreseeable future to the extent we can rely upon them from here in the United States, from the tar sands in Canada, from Mexico perhaps, or other friendly places. That addresses the immediate national security concern. He's right, though, in the larger sense. We do want, I think, to put this country on a footing whereby it is less sensitive than it is today on what might happen to the oil market writ large. And that's, I think, a step, to take an example, a step that we see working right now is Brazil, in which some 40% of the fleet of cars operating in Brazil use pure ethanol. They derive it not from corn, but from sugar. It's very efficient, and it has greatly reduced the shocks of higher oil prices on the Brazilian economy. It's the sort of thing that makes sense for their national security as well as their economy. I believe it's the sort of thing that would greatly help our economy, in fact, even more so.
Jerry Taylor with Cato, back to you on that. Would you then agree that it would be a good idea for the government to try to encourage the development of alternative fuels, ethanol, methanol, whatever, that can be manufactured in this country, get a stable supply, take us off the oil economy at the same time?
Well, you have to realize that market investors are doing that already. Back in 1973, 6% of U.S. GDP was devoted to oil purchases. Today, that figure is 2%. That was not the result of a major federal initiative, though there were regulations at the time that were adopted, but they were relatively minor contributors here. The main reason is that the American economy responded to price signals. When oil becomes expensive, people have an incentive to conserve, to look towards alternative technologies, to invest in new supply, and to do all the sorts of positive things that Frank Gaffney would like us to do. So price signals are going to do all of this for us. The only real question is it best to leave it to market market agents responding to price signals to steer these investments, or is it best to have government somehow steer them? My fundamental complaint with leaving this to government is that in the real world of Washington, D.C., decisions about who gets subsidies, who gets help, who gets assistance or whatnot are not based on economic criteria or technological criteria. They're based on political criteria. Who's got the lobbyists? Who's got campaign contributors? Who's got organized constituencies in key congressional districts? They're the folks who get helped, not necessarily the groups that have merit. And so whenever we hear these kind of calls, in the past we've given money to very robust political coalitions that have essentially been very bad bets, and it will always be that case.
Jerry Taylor with Cato. Back to Dan Lashoff, a senior scientist, deputy director of the Climate Center, the Natural Resources Defense Council. Again, I want to get you back in this conversation. I'm not sure you're supportive of what Frank Gaffney said earlier about tar sands and oil shale and other sources of petroleum. But what do you say to what we just heard from Jerry Taylor, that incentives, when they come out of Washington, are often given for the wrong reasons?
Well, I think he's right about that. You know, it is possible to have bad corporate welfare bills, but we also have experience with effective government policies, such as improving fuel efficiency standards for automobiles, which we did in the 70s, and performance-based incentives that reward investors for producing what we are looking for, whether that's ethanol or advanced hybrid vehicles that meet a certain performance specification, rather than rewarding people for how many dollars they spend. We've done both kinds of policies. We know that performance-based standards and incentives work, and we know that corporate welfare is just that. It's corporate welfare, but it doesn't produce the results we want.
Jerry Taylor with Cato, any problem with performance-based incentives?
Well, performance-based incentives are always in the eye of the beholder, after all. Someone could argue the Clean Coal Technology Program is an incentive-based program. The problem with the regulations, which are supposed to drive conservation, is that they always have unintended side effects. For instance, one of the unintended side effects of increasing fuel efficiency standards on the auto fleet is that you get an increase in vehicle miles traveled. This is well understood by all the economists who've looked at the data. And there are two consequences from this. One, you get more congestion on the roads, which nobody likes. And two, you get an increase in pollution from the auto fleet, because by increasing vehicle miles traveled, you encourage a net increase in tailpipe emissions. And this has been demonstrated by economists at Penn State University and Clemson. Those are the only studies that have been done on this subject. They find the same things. So while it's all well and good to encourage conservation, the problem is if you do it without, say, just a general broad-based tax, and you try to get into the guts of the economy and try to regulate this, that, or the other, or subsidize this, that, or the other, you almost always create more problems than you solve.
So, Dan Lashoff, back to you, Natural Resources Defense Council. Are efforts at more fuel efficiency then counterproductive?
No, they're not. It's true that if the cost of driving goes down, people will drive slightly more, but that's a very small effect, perhaps about 10%. So if you double fuel efficiency standards, instead of cutting oil consumption in half, maybe you cut it by 45%. So we're still way ahead by doing that. And again, real-world experience as opposed to theoretical models show that this, in fact, works. And that is, you know, one element of a comprehensive policy that we need to reduce oil consumption. As far as just leaving it to the market, the problem is that's what we've done for the last 20 years, and that's how we've gotten into the situation we're in today, where we import more than 60% of our oil, and where our oil consumption is continuing to increase, where we're dependent on dangerous sources of petroleum, and where we're continuing to pump heat-trapping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at ever-increasing levels. So we can't just rely on the market, and there clearly is a role for government in setting appropriate standards when there's a national security or an environmental issue at stake. And this is something that both Republicans and Democrats have recognized, you know, for years, starting with Teddy Roosevelt right through Richard Nixon. Environmental protection has been a highly bipartisan effort, and only recently has it seemed to become more partisan. And I'm glad that, you know, with this Set America Free coalition, we're moving back to a much broader bipartisan approach to some of these issues.
When we began this program, we talked about what you and Frank Gaffney's group, the Center for Security Policy, are both advocating, and that is this flexible fuel vehicle that would also be a plug-in, a hybrid, using or generating as a result a product that could get to 300 to 50 to 500 miles per gallon of gasoline, again, that being possible partly because of the use of the ethanol and other alternative fuels. Dave Hermance is Executive Engineer for Advanced Technology Vehicles for Toyota of North America. And Dave Hermance, welcome to you.
I'm glad to be here.
You've been listening to this conversation. I'm sure you're familiar with these arguments, but let's get back to this technology. Is it, in fact, as has been said, not just by Frank Gaffney, but in Newsweek magazine and the Wall Street Journal and other places, existing technology that's available right now that if we just decided to implement it, we'd could get it on the road?
No, it's not quite that easy. The vehicles that have been modified, the vehicles that have been talked about in the public press recently are modified versions of grid-independent or non-plug-in hybrid vehicles. And the modifications, while they provide some level of utility, are fairly limited in scope. The vehicle still is in electric mode, is only capable of 35 miles an hour top speed, and has fairly glacial acceleration performance, and costs $15,000 to $25,000 more money. That type of vehicle with those limitations and that cost is not likely to be well received by the buying public. So it takes a different vehicle than exists. Might have merit, but right now the battery cost is very high and the utility is reduced from conventional vehicles. And customers today clearly signal they're not willing to accept a compromise in the vehicle that they're driving today.
You said $25,000 or so more per vehicle. That would be double the cost of a Prius, for example. If you had mass production, wouldn't that bring the price down?
It brings it down somewhat, but it's still going to wind up being a 10%, $10,000 premium in all probability, given the amount of battery you have to put on the vehicle.
Well, now you were talking about an engine that works just with electricity. They're talking about a flexible fuel vehicle that works with electricity, but also with ethanol, methanol, and so on. Couldn't you do the same thing with that you do now with the Prius?
You could indeed make Prius a flex fuel vehicle if there were sufficient supply of flex fuel available to use it. As was pointed out, there are several million vehicles certified to run on flexible fuel today, and almost no stations that vend the product, so nobody is realizing that benefit other than those who are getting a CAFE benefit from it. So, yes, flex fuel is possible. It would be desirable to have more than one fuel in the transportation mix. The question becomes one of economics about how do you go about doing it in a manner that keeps everybody in business and keeps process moving forward.
Yes, Toyota looked into the possibility of installing the kind of infrastructure that would be needed to provide flexible fuels nationwide. What would it cost?
Well, no, we leave that to the energy sector to make that decision, but apparently it takes more than has been brought to bear so far. It has to be economically viable all the way down the line. Just, you know, we can't be in a position where government perpetually provides incentives. It has to, at the end of the game, become a viable, cost self-sufficient process, or it's a waste of money in the beginning.
Dave Hermance, Executive Engineer for Advanced Technology Vehicles for Toyota of North America. Back to Frank Gaffney, our first guest with the Center for Security Policy. What do you say to this critique of the 500-mile-per-gallon vehicle?
Well, I'm not quite sure whether we're talking past one another or not, but what we're emphasizing is very much a hybrid vehicle, not simply an electrical only vehicle. It is one that would, in fact, be able to take advantage of flexible fuels. And the point is certainly well taken, and it is very much part of our strategy to encourage the infrastructure to adapt to provide flexible fuels to consumers who will have the capability to take advantage of them. For example, you can start almost immediately with state and local fleets, or federal fleets for that matter, by making sure that the central pumping stations which supply them with their fuel have flexible fuel features. But it costs, we're told, on the order of about $20,000 per pump to clean them out and make them available, the existing pumps, for pumping in ethanol or methanol or some blend. That is the kind of thing that, going back to Jerry's point, I think the market will get around to at some point, but as he put it in a previous show we did together, at the end of the day. And my concern, just so we're very clear about this, is we, I believe, do not have the luxury of waiting for the end of the day, for the market to get around to this. If, as I fear, we may suffer some very significant disruption in the supply of oil, which will affect, of course, not only our economy, but others as well, we are going to be throwing money at precisely the kinds of initiatives that we're talking about here. It will take longer to bring them to bear. It will cost more. Most of Jerry's concerns will be even more, I think, pronounced under those emergency circumstances. The nature of a government involvement at this point is not to pick winners and losers. It's to encourage the widest possible diversification of our transportation sector's energy supplies. And that can be done, I believe, including plug-in hybrids, far more economically and far faster if we have the wit to get going on it now rather than to do it later under much more difficult circumstances.
Let me go back first to Dave Hermance of Toyota. What do you say to what we just heard? Would Toyota get into the business of producing these flexible fuel plug-in hybrids if, in fact, it had incentives to do it?
Well, it depends on the character of the Senate. We're not looking for a government handout. I don't want to be part of that group. By the same token, at the end of this transition, whatever the transition looks like, the product has to be economically viable. There has to be a customer that's willing to pay the price to buy the vehicle. And looking at the economics of plug-in vehicles today, it's not obvious that you get to that point.
But so you'd need the kinds of changes that Frank Gaffney was talking about. You'd need the pumping stations and all the other things involved.
Well, the pumping stations are related to the fuel burnt in the combustion engine. The plug-in is related to the size of the battery pack. The size of the battery pack is the issue that clearly or that today is seriously not clear about it. It'll ever be economically viable. The flex fuel on the combustion side is a different matter, needing the availability of the fuel.
Back to Frank Gaffney. What about that? The battery pack never economically viable, according to Dave Hermance.
Well, you know, I hope that that is not the case. I understand that not to be the case. If Toyota is taking that position as a company, it would surprise me, frankly, because I keep hearing reports from industry sources that they're actually working. Maybe it's the Toyota back in Japan, not the Toyota here, but they're working hard at trying to figure out how to make these batteries economical and give you at minimum 20 miles per gallon per 20 miles range, which would be sufficient for most of American drivers' purposes. But here's the problem. You can, I think, bet that somebody, whether it's the Germans, whether it's Honda instead of Toyota, whether it's Detroit, somebody is going to figure out that Americans would much prefer to get 500 miles per gallon of gasoline, if they can, at an affordable price, and in a way that would be supportive of our national interests, then to continue to drive around in cars that have similar power and similar numbers of cups for holding drinks and so on, the features that we've become accustomed to. And the challenge to industry, and I think to government both, is to try to make that existing technology, technology in hand, technology certainly around the corner, available to the widest possible number of consumers as quickly as possible because, I would argue, of the national security interests.
I want to go back to Dan Lashoff with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Aren't there some environmental problems with these alternative fuels? You mentioned the difficulties with ethanol, I think, a little earlier, having to do with corn, and you preferred other agricultural crops to that. Also, there's the issue that if you're going to operate with electricity and have a grid available for cars to be plugged in, you got to generate the electricity. And at the moment, we may not have the ability to do that unless we go to clean coal or nuclear or something else that you as an environmentalist have problems with.
Well, it makes a great deal of difference how you make the fuel, whether that's ethanol or electricity that you put in a vehicle. If you look at how we're making ethanol today and on average how we're making electricity today, switching to either of those from gasoline is probably a modest net gain, but not anything to get real excited about. I think the potential that we see is in improving the way we make ethanol, both making our corn-based ethanol production more efficient and switching to other feedstocks, which are inherently more efficient and better for the environment, as I mentioned, switchgrass or agricultural waste. And on electricity, switching to increasing our reliance on renewable sources of electricity, such as wind or biomass electricity, or, in fact, clean coal if it's truly clean, which means that you're capturing the carbon dioxide that's produced when coal is burned. I think that could be part of a cleaner electricity grid.
That's all for this edition of To the Point. Once again, it was recorded last spring with Dan Lashoff, Senior Scientist, Deputy Director of the Climate Center at the Natural Resources Defense Council, Frank Gaffney, President, Founder of the Center for Security Policy, Jerry Taylor, Director of Natural Resource Studies at the Cato Institute, and Dave Hermance, Executive Engineer for Advanced Technology Vehicles for Toyota of North America. There is scientific evidence that all of humanity came out of Africa, but nobody's sure how our ancestors got themselves to other parts of the planet. Now, the National Geographic Society, with help from IBM, hopes to solve the mystery by sampling DNA. We'll hear more in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the Point, all one word, .com.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The National Geographic Society will collect 100,000 blood samples from indigenous populations around the world. Then researchers at 10 local centers will analyze the DNA and trace the migration routes first established some 50,000 years ago. Dr. Spencer Wells is the population geneticist who is leading the project called Genographic. We're very delighted to have you with us, Dr. Wells. This is a very ambitious undertaking.
Thanks, Warren. It's great to be on the show.
Can you describe how it is that DNA samples of people living today can reveal migration patterns that occurred 50,000 years ago?
Well, when we pass on our DNA to our children, if we choose to have children, we pass on many things to them. And some of the things that we pass on are characteristics that define us, you know, make us look a certain way or perhaps, you know, act a certain way. But we also pass on a few changes in that DNA, what we call mutations, random changes. They're spelling mistakes during the process of copying the DNA. And when we pass these on down through the ages, they mark lines of descent. They don't occur very often. A rate of roughly 50 per genome per generation. So each child has roughly 50 of these random spelling mistakes in their DNA code that distinguish them from their parents. But when they are passed on, they again form these lines of descent. And if you share these genetic markers, as we call them, with other people, it's a sign that you share an ancestor in the past. And so that's what we're studying, is the ways these genetic markers link up into common ancestry and how they show us the migratory paths of our ancestors as they moved around the world.
What's known now about those migratory paths, and how do you hope to increase knowledge about them?
Well, we have a kind of broad brush view of early human migrations at this point. I mean, I think science has pretty resoundingly answered the question of origins. We all ultimately trace back to Africa within the last couple of 100,000 years. And at some point, probably around 50 to 60,000 years ago, some bands of Africans began to leave that continent to go out and populate the rest of the planet. But in terms of the migratory routes they would have followed to do that, we really don't have a very clear picture at the moment. We have a view of the forest, but we don't really know that much about the details of the trees, and that's really what we're hoping to find out about.
Has the geography itself changed, or the ecology that sits on it?
Well, certainly the climate has changed a lot. Now, in terms of, you know, continental drift, no, the continents are in roughly the same places today that they were back then. But the sea levels have changed because, actually, when we started to leave Africa around 50 to 60,000 years ago, we were in the grips of the last ice age. And that had the effect of sucking up a lot of the moisture on the planet into these growing ice sheets in the northern hemisphere, and that lowered the sea levels. So the coastlines would have been slightly different. And also the extent of the deserts, the extent of forests and so on would have changed slightly from what we would recognize today. But, you know, in terms of general landforms, yeah, they were probably pretty similar.
There's a lot of overlapping of different kinds of scientific evidence here.
Yeah, this is really a kind of synthetic endeavor to decipher details about our history as a species. You know, we as geneticists have this ability to trace genealogy, to trace biological relationships between people. But those patterns only make sense in the light of archaeological evidence, paleoanthropology, linguistics, climatology, and so on. And we actually have some world experts in these other fields as part of our advisory board for the project.
Talking with Dr. Spencer Wells, geneticist, anthropologist, leader of the Genographic Project. What about the DNA samples themselves? It's going to take some time for analysis of 100,000 of them. That's a lot. I've heard it suggested that not all the samples may last long enough to provide the kind of analysis that you require.
No, DNA samples stick around for a long time in the lab, but the real issue is the sampling. It's, you know, what we've done today with this project is to launch it to the world. We have invited the entire world to participate in finding out about our shared history as a species, and it is very clear that we do have a shared history as a species. We're each connected by genetic threads, and you know, the kind of tapestry of diversity we see around the world today is produced by the migration patterns of our ancestors. So, you know, it's an opportunity for members of the general public and for indigenous populations to participate. The issue with the indigenous groups is that they provide us perhaps with our clearest glimpse of human migratory history because they retain more of the context in which that genetic variation arose. They've lived in the same place perhaps for very long periods of time, or they speak a distinctive language. They have a direct connection with their ancestry that many of us have lost. And they're the key groups to really mapping out these migratory routes. They provide us with the signposts. So it's a question of talking to these groups about what it is we hope to learn from their genetic samples, and we viewing this whole process as a collaboration between the scientists and the indigenous populations, and you know, getting the samples, which is key to the whole undertaking.
When your whole undertaking involves the movement of people from place to place, how do you determine who's indigenous and who's not?
That's a great question. What constitutes an indigenous group? Well, again, you know, there are people who perhaps have lived in the same place for a very long period of time, who perhaps speak a distinctive language. You know, one of the proxies we use in choosing populations that we want to approach for sampling is, you know, language. And there are around 6,000 languages spoken in the world today. So potentially there are as many as 6,000 different populations. But one thing to bear in mind is that we are actually losing many of those languages. We're losing many populations as people migrate to cities, take on the attributes of the dominant culture, perhaps. Between half and 90% of the languages spoken in the world today will be extinct, no longer spoken by the end of the century, many within the next generation. So we really have a closing window of opportunity to take this genetic snapshot of our species before they're gone.
Very quickly, are you worried about people who consider themselves indigenous and perhaps in some sense pure, and who really don't want to deal with the question of whether or not they're related to other people in the same species, but who have, they believe, different and perhaps inferior characteristics?
Well, I think most people find it kind of interesting to learn about these genetic connections with people all over the world, people they perhaps haven't met. And, you know, if individuals choose not to participate, of course, that's absolutely fine. But we hope that everybody will get excited about being involved in a real-time scientific endeavor and that we will get the sort of participation we need to make it happen.
We look forward very much to following this and hope you'll come back from time to time and give us progress reports.
I'd love to, Warren.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Spencer Wells, again, geneticist, anthropologist, and leader of the Genographic Project at the National Geographic Society. Today's program produced by Cameron Radziner, Christian Bordahl, and Katie Cooper, technical director John Patrick Costello. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
KRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.